Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. More than an inch of rain fell on south central Pennsylvania this weekend. For the year to date, most of the region is 10 to 15 inches above normal for rainfall. Most of that rain has come between July and November. The wet weather has created several problems that include damaged homes or vehicles from flooding. Sometimes that damage was covered by insurance. Other times, it wasn't. Flood insurance may be one of the least understood and maybe most expensive forms of insurance in some cases. Joining us today is Jim Enders, Vice President of Enders Insurance, to talk about flood insurance. Jim Enders, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thanks for the opportunity.
If you have a question or a comment about flood insurance, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I said welcome back, Jim, because we've spoken about this topic several times. You're kind of our guru on flood insurance, but it is so timely right now just because of the amount of rain that this region has seen this year. I don't know whether you can give me any facts or figures or just anecdotes, but it would seem that there would be a lot of people who have questions about, a lot more people who have questions about flood insurance this year than maybe in previous years.
No question. 2018 has been a extremely challenging year in reference to just the magnitude of water that we've seen. Not necessarily the typical type of flooding, but just lots of thunderstorms, lots of rain for a period of time, significant in nature. And this is the issues that we're having with regard to flood.
8 of the 10 costliest natural disasters in the history of this country involve flooding. Should everyone have flood insurance?
Everyone should have flood insurance. 90% of all natural disasters involve flooding. Typically, we think of the house that sits on top of the hill, and let's go take our comments to California. Now, California had a lot of wildfires, which obviously burn all the brush and the land that holds water. After the fire happens, now we have major flooding events because the water has nowhere to go, or it just runs down the hill, and now we have mud flow, which is a part of the flood program. So even though that home sits on top of the hill, it has areas where flood is the peril that needs to be protected, and the homeowner's policy doesn't provide flood.
Something I'm curious about, I had never heard this before, that mudslides are part of the flooding program. When you say part of it, meaning what?
Well, when you talk about the definition of what a flood is, a flood is a sudden inundation of water on normally dry land. Mud flow is a part of the flooding program, the flood policy, because now we have water along with sediment and dirt that turns into mud that flows. And that is extremely damaging because now we have more weight because of the earth running into the building.
But that's California. The topography is different. Pennsylvania has had its share of wildfires over recent years, but nothing like they've had in California. What's different, I mean, here in Pennsylvania, why should Pennsylvanians, unless you live next to a body of water, why should Pennsylvanians have flood insurance?
Because what we're seeing now in reference to the magnitude of rain, we all think of floods as, gee, the Susquehanna River, all of its tributaries, Swidara Creek, and you look at it and now it's coming up and getting ready to get into your home. When realistically, we also have to look at water coming from above, and this is where the moderate to low flood risk areas are prone. And we're seeing that repeatedly this year because of the magnitude of rain.
What kind of damages?
Oh, just significant. And tended to be more nuisance than anything else. The water comes in, it goes out, and now we have a muddy mess. Many people have finished basements with sump pumps, and they think the sump pump is the end-all be-all, but we also have to have electricity. So if the electricity goes out, we're in big problems because now there's no sump pump.
You know, there are a lot of answers to this question, and we're going to be talking about some of the specifics throughout the program. But how is a flood insurance policy different than, say, a homeowner's policy or any other type of insurance?
Water is probably one of the most misunderstood perils on a homeowner's policy. The water provision on the homeowners typically is for something that is sudden and accidental. The pipe breaks, the toilet overflows. When we have water that comes from the ground through a sump pump, that is actually something that excluded on a typical homeowner's policy. Where people end up having coverages, they ended up, their agent have provided a buyback, and we call it backup a sewer and drain. And that is a sublimit. So it's not, hey, I got total coverage or full coverage. There is actually a limit. Some of the high-value homes may provide the same limit as what the other limits are on the policy, but you have to read the contract.
Mm-hmm. So I want to give some examples here. You said that many people think about the damage that they get. You know, I was reading about some examples. There's a storm outside. Wind, maybe a tree comes down, breaks a window. Rain comes in, damages furniture or the carpet, something like that. Something like that would be covered by a homeowner's policy, correct?
Correct. The peril for the tree falling would actually be a wind event. The residing damage is water, but the true actual cause of the event would have been wind.
But then getting to examples that aren't covered, the one that most people think about and maybe have experienced this year is when water comes up in the basement, as you described, and the furniture may be damaged, the carpet may be destroyed, all has to be replaced. A typical homeowner's policy would not cover that, correct?
That is correct, unless they add something special like the water backup sewer drain to their policy. Then they would have the sublimit.
Mm-hmm. Why is that? What was the thinking behind that? I mean, I'm not asking you to defend it, but what's the thinking behind having a big difference in a homeowner's policy that you would need a flood insurance policy?
In reading over the years, lower levels, anything below grade, was never intended to be living space. If we go back and in history and look in the Northeast, all the old homes that had basements truly, before refrigeration, was a place that they could keep things basically cool, like food or anything that they would need to keep cool. The basement is where that was kept. It wasn't an area that was truly used as living space.
That probably changed in the 1960s, I can imagine, because I'm thinking back to my grandparents' homes and all that, exactly what you described, food, tools, a lot of things that you would kind of keep in storage. But then when my parents built a house, we had a rec room, or what became known as the family room, and it became living space.
Exactly. And that became the beginning stages of having issues with water in areas that truly shouldn't have been living space. If we take our thoughts down to the Southeast, they look at us in the Northeast as, you have what? You have a basement? What's the purpose of a basement? Obviously, the Southeast having different soil, there is no basements. Typically, they have a little bit larger homes, but there's storage elsewhere above ground.
do, as I describe this program, as flood insurance maybe being one of the most misunderstood forms of insurance. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
What don't people understand about it?
The biggest misnomer is there's no water around me. I'm not in a special flood hazard program. I'm not in the moderate rating as far as low level. I sit a little bit higher. That means water can't get to me. Therefore, I don't have the exposure. I'm not going to worry with flood insurance.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were talking about hazard areas or even a moderate area. What you're describing is that certain areas or different areas are given different risk assessments. How is that done?
The federal government has mapping programs, and it delineates. Army Corps of Engineers developed all the maps, and that delineates the high-risk areas or the special flood hazard areas. And your listeners definitely know that because if they have a mortgage, they were required to buy flood insurance in order to get the mortgage. The moderate areas sit a little bit higher. We talk about the special flood areas as the 100-year floodplain. And if you look at statistically, you're bound to have a flood at a 1 out of 3 1 out of 3 chance of having a flood during your time that you have the mortgage. Obviously, that is why the mortgage company wants you to have flood insurance.
But you just talked about the 100-year flood plan. There's a commercial that's running right now for an insurance company that says that, and he's talking about referring to climate change, that I assume so, that those 100-year floods are becoming more common.
They are, and I just read an article, and it was put out by Zillow, and they were talking about, obviously, climate change, but they were also talking about that they feel that the federal government flood maps are antiquated, and they just can't keep up with the changing building and growth of coastal areas. And I think that is going to be a reflection of the 100-year floodplain, that there could potentially be changes down the road.
When you say that this article said it was antiquated, how often do they update those maps?
Well, the United States is an awfully, awfully big area. And with budgets and limitations of what the Army Corps of Engineers can do, they update maps as frequently as they can do it. Dauphin County was updated in 2014, pretty common, 2014 or 15. So it hasn't been all that long ago. But if you think about the growth of the county, that can change very quickly. And for them to come back and redo the maps more frequently, that's not realistic.
It's not just the climate, it's also development. Because, let's face it, if there's topography that changes, new roads put in, parking lots, those things all have an impact on where water flows.
Absolutely. Use the example of the rec room in the 1960s. We've seen tremendous growth since then. Urban sprawl is a major factor because I had somebody that built a home, and in the neighborhood next door to it was an old neighborhood, and they never got water before that new development was constructed. And it was no question when they started moving dirt around and building things, whether you have adequate retention areas, it's still going to affect older neighborhoods.
We're going to take your phone calls. If you have questions about flood insurance, give us a call. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're discussing flood insurance today with Jim Enders, Vice President of Enders Insurance. let's face it, 2018 has been one of the wettest record, or one of the wettest years on record. I think York County has already set a record for rainfall. Lancaster County, last I heard, about a half inch away from setting a record. Number of other counties around the state, I think Washington, D.C. has set a record. We know there has been a lot of rainfall this year, and a lot of people are probably being surprised with what their homeowner's policy covers, what it doesn't, the need for flood insurance. If you have questions about any of these things, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's go to Faith in Lancaster. Faith, you're on the air.
Thank you. My comment about flood insurance, yes, it would be wonderful to have it along with other types of insurance, but the cost is tremendous. For example, I had it a number of years, but then we got so much flooding, and I live in a least likely area, and I priced the flood insurance. It had doubled. It was, I believe, almost $500, and that was about almost as much as my total homeowner's insurance. And one comment I also about the sump pumps, if you lose electricity, you know, you can, of course, get sump pumps with backup batteries for some assistance. Mm-hmm. And that's my only comment.
Well, so, Faith, you brought up an issue that many other people have, so thank you very much for your call. And Jim, we were getting to this because if there is a reason that people don't get in flood insurance, one is they probably think they don't need it, but the second, maybe the biggest reason, is the cost. I was looking back over our records, and the first time I had you on the program talking about this was in 2013 when the rates had doubled, maybe even quadrupled, gone 10 times what they were in some areas of the country. This is not a cheap, inexpensive type of insurance, is it?
It is not. And I feel for Faith. Couple things that you have to understand about the flood insurance program. It's $30.4 billion in debt. We are going to have, I don't want to call it a crisis, but it's a concern. Friday, the government...
I don't know. That sounds like a crisis to me, Jim.
The government is planning on a partial shutdown on Friday unless President Trump and the Congress can come to some resolution on the border wall. Part of that situation is the flood insurance funding. If they can't come to a resolution or put a separate bill in, they did the same thing 14 days ago. So here we are again, and it continues. The funding is a major, major issue. They are at the ceiling cap right now of what they're able to spend on claims. The NFIP has about $1.4 billion in losses annually.
Well, let's back up a little bit, provide some context. The NFIP is the National Flood Insurance Program.
Yes.
Flood insurance, this type of insurance is different in other ways than, say, your typical homeowner's insurance, in that the federal government kicks in money here. And as you just mentioned, $30 billion in the hole. And a lot of that has to do with the number of floods, the number of claims across the country. So how exactly does that work? If someone purchases a policy, a flood insurance policy, where do the feds come into this?
Well, it's a federal program because no private insurance carrier wants to take this animal on because look at it, it doesn't make money. You know, insurance companies are in business to make money. Now, this all reflects back on Faith's comments of it's so expensive. Now, hopefully there's a resolution on Friday that they can at least kick the can down the road and we can keep the program going, because if not, there's a moratorium, no changes get done, no policies get get written. And if you have a settlement on Thursday, Friday, Monday of next week, you might want to start thinking about making some other alternatives to purchasing flood insurance. And where I'm going is private markets.
Okay, I want to talk about that, but I just want to clarify, if the government is not funded, government is shut down, what does that mean to the typical homeowner? I mean, if there would be, say, a flood claim put in on Friday or Saturday, if there's no resolution, what does that mean?
That means that the whole world stops. Now, I don't know if they would go ahead and process the claim, adjust the claim, but no payment would go out. So I can't answer whether anything would happen or they would continue to work on it, but there would be no claim check until the program is funded.
All right, so $30 billion deficit in flood insurance. That's unsustainable. It keeps growing. Just this time last year, it was only $24 billion, $25 billion. I say only. But there's been a big growth even in the past year, past 2 years. That's unsustainable.
And one of the things that President Trump has done is advocated for private markets. So basically what that means is the more insurance companies we can get involved in the program, the better opportunity we can stop the bleeding, so to speak, on the federal program. Now, you also have to realize that no private insurer would want to take the repetitive loss policies where the homeowner or the building owner would continually have claim after claim after claim. But what we're talking about is the moderate areas, the low-risk areas, and the private markets actually have been in writing policies in the special flood hazard zones.
But I get back to your comment about insurance companies not wanting to take on that risk. I mean, they see what's going on. The people working in the insurance industry see what's going on. They see more rain every year. They see more damage caused by flooding every year. Why would they take it on? I mean, unless they're forced to do it by the government. And even if that be the case, wouldn't the policies, the premiums be so high that it would just be very difficult for people to afford?
Agreed. Anybody that is in the special flood hazard zone has seen increases year after year after year. The recommendation their agents should make is to go ahead and get an elevation certificate. That might not assist them today, but at some point in time, it'll help them, rather than continue to take these rate increases, because what the program wants to do is to get the full risk rate premium. They've been subsidizing the premiums since 1968. So what the program itself is trying to do is eliminate all those subsidies. Biggert Waters in 2014, and that was
a law.
That was a law.
We talked about, yeah.
It just eliminated all the subsidies immediately, and that is where you saw flood insurance premiums just unaffordable.
Yeah, I look back on our records. There was a guy in Louisiana. I mean, there were a lot of anecdotes. A man in Louisiana who was paying $300 a year, and his bill went to $28,000 a year. And I mean, that sounds incredible, but that's actually what happened to some people.
And it goes one step further. It generates a banking crisis. That gentleman probably had a mortgage, and he looked at it and said, "I'm out of here. The bank can have my house because there's no way I can afford it."
So, curious, and I think I know the answer to this. It's probably a dumb question, but homeowners who have had multiple claims, their rates, just like someone in a car who has multiple accidents, their rates go up. I mean, after your first claim, your flood insurance rates go up?
Actually, it doesn't.
What? Am I thinking, I thought it was a dumb question. Am I thinking logically here?
No, what we're getting at is, keep in mind, you're getting increases every year because you're getting your subsidy taken away. If you have continue to have claims, the federal government is monitoring every single flood policy out there. When you reach a certain amount of claim payout versus what premium that you're paying, it goes into the federal government's repetitive loss program. And really what the federal government wants to do eventually is purchase your home because you have a coverage called ICC, increased cost to compliance. So they're going to either do one of two things. They're going to assist you in making your property so that we can minimize the risk of flood. In other words, elevate your home. If that's not an option, they will eventually come to you and say, we would like to buy your home. And at that point in time, they would destroy the home and give the land to the municipality to use for green space.
Let's go who do we have on the phone? It's Mufina in Harrisburg. Mufina, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. It's actually Mufina.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I got a pronouncer here, but I was looking at F-E-I-N is fine. So, all right, sorry to mispronounce your name.
No problem. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
And my question, I may have missed it while I was dialing in when you were providing the information, but my question is about the elevation certificate. I live in Harrisburg. I've not had any issues with flooding in over 30 years. Received notices over the years from the city saying that the flood insurance cost should go down. Of course, it's never going down. It's always going up, as you said. And then I received notice that I need to have an elevation certificate. So I got someone to do that and sent it off to my broker to provide to the flood insurance and never heard anything back. So I just wanted to know what should I expect around that, because my thought was that once I submitted that, my rates would go down. Mm-hmm. But I didn't receive any response whatsoever.
Hey, thank you very much for your call. What should she expect?
This is a difficult situation. Now, the letter that she received from the city saying that her rates would go down, that was probably part of the community rating. All cities, governments, municipalities that are involved in the flood program are part of the community rating. And Harrisburg has done a great job at trying to find ways to mitigate flooding. And the federal government rewards them with discounts. The problem is, again, going back to the subsidies. The subsidies that are being taken away are a higher amount than what the community rating is. So she would have seen relief without the rate increases. Now she got the flood and she got the elevation certificate, which is a good thing. The issue as an insurance agent, it's hard for me to tell the customer when the bleeding is going to stop and when the subsidies are over. She'll find out quickly when the elevation certificate kicks in because she'll stop having rate increases.
Just so, and I want to explain this because it is different than other type of policies. Someone who would want to purchase flood insurance does it through you, through an insurance broker, correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay, even though this is a program administered by the federal government.
Correct. Now, one thing that I am going to recommend to her is to go to her broker and ask if they can get her a quote through a private flood program, private market program. That may save her some money. Hmm. Now, there are some caveats to that, but that's something that she'd want to discuss with her broker.
We have Ken, and Ken is actually from Georgetown, South Carolina. Ken, are you traveling in the area?
Yes, I'm actually visiting in Chambersburg,
Pennsylvania. Oh, okay. All right, so what's your question or comment?
Well, and I have flood insurance. I also have homeowner's insurance. I recently had to purchase wind insurance. So my coverage is somewhat fragmented. And reading the policy, I came across a clause which is called exclusionary clause.
So you're curious what that is?
Pardon me?
You're curious what that means?
Well, the exclusionary clause, as I read it, if a hurricane causes damage to my home, and then the flood comes in later, three or four days later, and causes further damage to my home, both companies can escape paying.
Okay, Jim, that doesn't sound right.
This is a result of 2005 Katrina. There were litigation in New Orleans time and time again where carriers were trying to figure out, was it a wind event or was it a flood event? Because the wind drove the water inland and caused the flood. So that was, and there's probably cases in Louisiana that still aren't resolved from that. So that is a result of that event of Katrina.
But what can Ken do? I mean, that sounds like a pretty big loophole.
It's a huge loophole, and I'm not sure if there's any resolution to it other than go to the open market and try to get it clarified. And this is a regional thing.
Where's Georgetown, Ken?
Georgetown is halfway or a third of the way from Myrtle Beach to Charleston on the coast. I live on a bay called the Winyah Bay, which is made up of five rivers and the intercoastal waterway.
What's your flood insurance cost, if I can ask?
Well, about $2,500 a year.
Okay.
And I did have a elevation certificate, and I will find out what my real premium is going to be, but it's going to be without a question higher than what I'm already paying.
Well, good luck to you. Thank you very much. I mean, that's mind-boggling that there's that kind of a loophole. Along those same lines, listener asked, if a house that has flood insurance and has a flood claims in the past, can a cracked foundation be included in a flood claim?
If it's deemed as a part of the flooding event, yes.
Jim, we're almost out of time for this portion of the program. I want to thank you very much for coming on. Obviously, there are a lot of questions out there. So what happens with this $30 billion deficit? What's the future look like?
Well, the future looks like we're going to have more and more carriers get involved in the flood program. That'll give folks like the listeners that called in the opportunity to shop for their flood insurance and hopefully get some relief on premium.
When you say shop, many people nowadays, they think about health care and health insurance. Are there some policies that maybe are not worth what you pay for them? I mean, is it one of those deals where the more you pay, the better the policy?
Not necessarily. Most of the private market contracts that I've seen do nothing more than emulate the federal program. But they have their actuaries, they have all the analytics at their disposal, and they're able to determine whether this particular home is going to be something that they would want to take on.
So even though I don't live near a body of water, I should put my house on stilts?
Not a bad idea.
Yeah, it sounds that way. We have a lot of houses on stilts. Jim Enders, Vice President of Enders Insurance, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's program, research shows that Dauphin County is the community that best represents Middle America anywhere in the country. Now, that may surprise you, but we'll be talking about that research, that survey that was done just a few weeks ago, or I should say was released just a few weeks ago. In his new book, While Reason Slept, Thomas Breyer Jr. tells the story of the nation's founding principles and how the men who wrote the Constitution envisioned government for the common good. He writes that the Constitution has been eroded by self-interest, consumerism, and propaganda. Joining us is Thomas Breyer Jr. Mr. Breyer, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Native of Hershey, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, if you have a question or comment, like to join in the conversation, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. So why did you want to write this book?
You know, it was kind of a spontaneous combustion, to be honest. So as you mentioned, I'm from Hershey. I went to Dickinson College undergrad, and I fell in love with philosophy there. I think it's phenomenally interesting. And I remember reading Plato's Republic, and he talks about, in the eighth book of the Republic, how all governments have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it's a fascinating thought. And so with our current state of affairs, I was just kind of trying to figure out, you know, at what point do we start thinking about, is it time to really make a concerted effort to change something? And so, you know, I was reading a lot about the founders, trying to understand the ideological origins of the revolution. And, you know, one day I decided, you know, I think there's enough here for a thesis. And I was talking to my friends about it, and my goal really was to just kind of inspire my generation to become aware of what the founding principles were, and to return to them and to try to make a concerted effort to bring it back.
The title itself says a lot about what's in the book, While Reason Slept. How'd you come up with that title?
Well, I borrowed from Churchill.
When I saw the book the first time, I thought, yeah, I think I recognize that a little bit, While England Slept.
Yeah, it's a great title. But, you know, Churchill is another character for me that is just phenomenally interesting. Beginning in 1932, he really recognized that the British were not prepared for the future. You know, in the first book of While England Slept, he talks about the analogy he draws between, you know, if you have an animal kingdom and the lion and the tiger both have a knife and no one else has a knife, then eventually you're going to be unprepared for what comes. And I think his message was so acute, and yet no one listened to it. You know, it wasn't until after Munich in 1938 that everyone started to say, okay, maybe he was right. And so
you said Munich in 1938 when England
when Chamberlain went to meet with Hitler
and said, "Oh, he'll be okay."
Yeah, and they had the bargain over Czechoslovakia, and they thought that would be the end of it, and they thought Hitler had made his last demands, and that just wasn't the case. And Churchill recognized that. He said, "You know, dictators cannot be appeased by kind words, and we have to really address the situation here and be assertive in doing so." And so I borrowed the title really from that standpoint, is to kind of maybe issue a warning in a sense. You know, if you look at what the purpose of government was for the founders, it's stunning, really. And Bernard Bailyn talks about this in his book, The Ideological Origins of the Revolution. The citations to Enlightenment rationalism and to ideas of reason in the writings of the time really is astonishing. And so if we want to understand how our government is supposed to work, we have to study that, and we have to understand precisely what it is for the founders that allows democracy to flourish.
Well, let's talk about that, because you write extensively about the founding of the nation, those who wrote the Constitution, and what they envisioned. And what they did envision, as you write, is that government and the people of this nation would work toward a common good. That would be their goal, common good for everyone. And as you write, the first 50 years of this country, that's kind of the attitude that government had and most Americans had. Before we go to what changed, talk about that and what the founders had in mind.
What they had in mind was breathtaking, really. I mean, if you think about mankind, it's really for the first time in human history that you have a group of people coming together and giving every single member of a society a title. You know, the word citizen had never existed in government before. You know, if you weren't fortunate enough to be a member of the elite class, you were a peasant. You know, you didn't really have a say in the government. And the founders recognized that if they really wanted to be true to the ideal, you know, what is the purpose of government? It's really for human flourishing. And so they thought, you know, and they debated. I think it's so fascinating. I think it really is the most interesting thought experiment there is whether are human beings capable of self-government?
There were actually members of the founders who thought maybe not.
Alexander Hamilton was the leading member of that category. And he argued that, you know what? He had read Thomas Hobbes, who I talk a little bit about in the book as well. And he said, you know, I think across the board, you know, maybe there are some people who are capable of looking out for others. But for the most part, human beings are governed by self-interest. And they're governed by the passions. And they're looking out for themselves, which is honestly understandable most of the time. I mean, life is very difficult. And if you're trying to live for yourself, that alone is a very consuming task. And then to ask you to consider other people as well is very daunting. And so Hamilton looked at it and said, listen, what we really should do is to model ourselves after a form of, you know, an aristocratic government where we have a single ruling class basically dictating to the citizens what is in their best interest. We can study, we can try to figure that out, and then tell them, you know, here's what we found. And that didn't prevail, obviously. The founders decided with proper education and with a really specific focus on education and the common good, like you said, democracy in its purest form can work.
I mentioned that you write in the book that America's first 50 years, that seemed to be the prevailing thought. But in the 1820s or so, when Andrew Jackson was president, you mentioned that there were changes afoot. What happened?
Well, and I wouldn't say it was like that for the first 50 years. I think, you know, almost from the beginning, they realized how difficult this would be. You know, they realized that perhaps this was a bit too idealistic. You know, their naivete almost was a virtue and a vice in a way. Because once you actually started to execute the practical aspects of government, you realize how profoundly difficult it is to rule an entire country on the basis of individual determination. And so there were ups and downs. Over time, though, with Jefferson in the presidency and Marshall in the Supreme Court, you had people who were dedicated to that ideal. But when Jackson came along in 1824, he really did feel, after losing the election to John Quincy Adams, that he had been betrayed. He thought that he alleged bargain and corruption on the part of Adams and Henry Clay. And so he set out to upend the political system, and he did so with remarkable success. He won every single southern and western state in the country, cleaned house, and ascended to the presidency in 1828. And he did so on a narrative that at its core was a focus on the commoner. And so, you know, you might say, okay, on the common man, that's a good thing. You know, the common good is what we're focusing on. But he did it in a way that ridiculed the very idea of education. You know, he said, what you are right now is good enough. You know, we don't need other people telling you what to do. We don't need other people telling you what to study or what you should do with your life. You know, you know better than anybody else. And he ridiculed John Quincy Adams. He called him, you know, an Indian-loving, bookish scholar, and kind of made a mockery out of his educational background. And he was very successful in doing that. And so he was really the first one to kind of weaponize somebody's educational background against them. And that's the inverse of what the founders had in mind, because education is really the most important thing. And by taking that and making intellectualism a vice rather than a virtue, he really upended the foundation upon which the founders had an idea for government.
In many ways, it doesn't seem like the nation's recovered from that.
You know, I think that's true, Scott. There have been pockets of progress, though. And every, you know, and I think that one of the reasons I wrote the book, too, is I look at 1968 as a parallel to where we are right now. You know, the Tet Offensive is in January. Martin Luther King is shot in April. Bobby Kennedy is shot in June. Nixon is elected in July on the back of the Southern Strategy. And then several hundred thousand people die in Vietnam, and you have Watergate. And Jimmy Carter said it in 1979. He goes, you know, in many ways, we haven't recovered from that. It's been a constant effort to try to, you know, rekindle that spirit of civic optimism that existed in the 1960s. And so
after John Kennedy.
After John Kennedy. Mm-hmm. And for a brief period there, I think with Robert Kennedy, too, mm-hmm. and Martin Luther King, because they really were the dual leaders of that movement.
Mm-hmm. Two people who play prominent roles in the book, Edward Bernays, if I'm pronouncing
that's
it
correct,
correctly,
yeah.
And Dale Carnegie, which many people are familiar with, Dale Carnegie. Who was Bernays?
Edward Bernays, and this was to me the most interesting part about the book because I had never heard the name before. Edward Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. He was a PSYOPs soldier in World War I, and he was responsible for America's propaganda mission in Latin America. And he was probably the first person in human history to figure out how to manipulate the masses through the proliferation of media. And he saw how remarkably successful that effort was. And so after the war, he basically took those lessons and applied them to the business and the political sphere. He was hired first by Calvin Coolidge. And, you know, there's a funny story where, you know, Coolidge was not regarded as having a very, you know, great image and not being very charismatic.
Yeah.
And
didn't smile. I mean, there were, you wrote about there were jokes in the media about the president never smiling.
Exactly. There was a dinner party one time where a young girl said, well, I bet I can make the president say, you know, more than three words. And he looked up and goes, you lose.
I don't know. He's kind of funny.
Funny, yeah. That's a witty remark. But no, so there was, it's kind of this kind of social view of Coolidge as somebody who wasn't very fun to be around. And so what Bernays did, and they hired Bernays to run his election campaign, he arranged for dozens of the biggest stars in the country, music, entertainment, Hollywood, I guess not Hollywood at the time, but Broadway. And they came to Washington, D.C., and they had this huge party on the White House lawn, and they had a concert, and the New York Times came and took pictures and everything. And, you know, the next morning is a picture of Calvin Coolidge on the front page, and it says, the president almost laughs. And he won that election by 25%, which to this day remains one of the largest victories in American history. And so Bernays, reflecting on that after the fact, said he realized for the first time that political campaigns really are all bombast. They're all parades. It's an entertainment industry more than a policy industry. And so people don't really care so much about what your ideas are for government as they do about really enjoying the political process. And the purest form of enjoyment is entertainment. And he figured that out. And he worked for Eisenhower and Harding after the fact and applied those same lessons in the political sphere.
But Dale Carnegie, I mean, Dale Carnegie is held up as a hero in many people's minds because he had wrote a book, How to Influence People, Make Them Like You. And, you know, people look at it and say, well, millions of people have self-confidence as a result of Dale Carnegie.
You know, I'm a little tough on Carnegie.
Yeah, you are.
Maybe in hindsight. because I respect what he did. You know, at the time he released his book in 1936, unemployment was at 16.9%, which is, it was just a devastating era in the Great Depression. And so the purpose for him writing that book was to give workers a sense of confidence again, to say that you have the power to control your own employment destiny. You know, you can develop these strong relationships and really become a part of capitalism and contribute to society. And I admire him for that. But at the same time, I do think if you look at what his blueprint is and you compare it to what, for example, Benjamin Franklin's was, if you look at the founders, there was always a civic unity between thought and action. Everything you did had to be, at the end of the day, a productive action for society. And so even if you were engaging in some form of selling or consumerism, you had to be honest. You had to be truthful. You had to treat people with respect across the board. And what Carnegie does is he really makes it about the person selling. And so you're selling yourself. You're not selling your idea. And it's more of an external image construction than kind of a method of proof. And I think that really has become the dominant means of influence today.
We only have a minute left, and there's so much more to talk about. So in your book, you talk about materialism, that how Americans have become so materialistic, and that people, a lot of politicians, a lot of people lack substance. People, and as you said, Bernays figured out that people will act on emotion, make decisions based on emotion. In the book, you offer some suggestions. In about 40 seconds, what are some of those things?
Well, I think the first thing we have to do is look at the preamble to the Constitution. And those are the constituent parts of the common good. It's order, tranquility, justice, and union. And Robert Kennedy, I think, is a perfect example of someone who embraced the public philosophy of citizenship in its purest form. And to right the ship here, we have to understand that we have to do better, not for ourselves, but for one another. And I think if we recognize that and we figure out a way to make the country great again on a communal scale And together, I think that we can figure this thing out.
Thomas Breyer, Jr., the author of the book, While Reason Slept, thank you very much. It's a provocative book, makes you think a lot about it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, as I mentioned, we're going to be talking about Dauphin County being designated as the best example of Middle America anywhere in the country. And that's coming up on tomorrow's show, so be sure to tune in.